What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. Now, John, I'm singing this.
Hey, we should get a little jingle, huh?
Yeah. America Trends podcast. Dun.
There you go.
Well, you know, I've been writing a lot of songs, John. And some of my songs are angry, but many of them are very, well, sad. Yeah. If they're not angry, they're sad often.
Well, angry, usually they're either breaking up.
Yeah,
or making up.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I was talking to a guy who programs a radio station recently, and I used to be a disc jockey when I was a kid, and it's remarkable how, well, algorithmic it's all gotten lately,
yeah.
Where they have a certain protocol using a computer telling them what kinds of music to play, how to back and front various forms of music to make sure that the flow is there, the rhythm, the key of the song, making certain that if they've got a kind of a Hispanic kind of artist, that they back that with a white and then a black artist. I mean, they've got all these different protocols that they use.
You know what I've noticed about the FMs? It seems like they have one group of music that they play it, but it's the same music. They just kind of mix it up a little bit.
They do.
Yeah.
I saw the program, songs. John. No, well, what they do, though, certain songs can be in the rotation many times. So you can have the same song.
You got to hear those hit songs.
Yeah, really. Six times in a day. Others are relegated to twice a day if they've got a little country flair and you're a regular album, a regular pop station. We only play that twice a day or whatever. But it was interesting because I had forgotten this notion. But, you know, instead of somebody boring us, what's the term? Give us the hook. Don't bore us, or something like that.
Give
us the hook. So the way that they test a lot of the music today, and always in a sense, was what is that either bridge to a song or the chorus?
Right.
Give us the chorus. Don't bore us. That's it. So what they'll do is they'll bring a lot of people, and FM focuses more on women. I don't know why, but basically, they'll bring a lot of women into a room and they'll ask them to...
Probably their ears are better.
Yeah, probably. And they'll scan and they'll go to a 12-second bridge and say, either that hits and clicks or it doesn't. It's not going to be a hit. There's a lot of science to what you're hearing on the radio. Yeah. Not with our podcast.
No, we're very
unscientific.
No, we actually play the B-side a lot.
Yeah, we do. The B-side topics. But I tell you, we've got an A-side topic this day. We really do. Because you know how I go out searching for things that I consider to be trendy and really interesting in our society. Not about, you know, dresses and shirts and ties. But I'm looking at really interesting social and political trends. So I found this one. Pop songs have become angrier and sadder. Scientists analyzed lyrics from 6,000 best-selling songs from the 1950s, John, when you and I were just little guys, to 2016 to make the finding. So using science, they looked at it and they said decidedly. Now, I don't know if all the keys are now minor because minor is sadder and angrier rather than major. But writing songs today, I tell you, I'm having so much fun with it. But I can see where somebody could get into a really angry mood when they look at what's going on around us.
I think rap is very angry.
Yeah.
I mean, it's you know, I mean, I guess they're speaking of social issues in their music, but it's really, you know, brings you down, the some of those songs that they do.
But even in our time, John, there were two songs that my band still does. One is Don't Let Me Down by the Beatles.
True.
And the other one was Don't Bring Me Down by the Animals, written by Carole King. So we brought people down in the old days, or The Eve of Destruction, which was a song by Barry McGuire. That, folks, go back and listen to that, because my father had such a judgment call as a general manager of a rock and roll station in the 60s, it was one of the biggest controversies. Do we play The Eve of Destruction or do we not? And you played it, and it was angry because, look, we were angry in the 60s, too, at times, about the Vietnam War, about civil rights and, you know, wanting to storm the ramparts. We had assassinations galore. I mean, we had a lot of issues.
But then again, the Imagine got...
That was a little bit later. Yeah,
and
in
then
the early
Puff
70s.
The Magic Dragon, I remember that wasn't allowed
well,
to
that
play.
Was about drugs. No, but seriously, though, we were at least imagining that we could make a better world. And so we were, in fact, being more hopeful and optimistic, even if the times we lived in were not. But now, as you say, and I think that's the important determinant, that a lot of the music is really coming from those who live in a ghetto environment, right, or have come from a place of, you know, unfortunate circumstance. And so if they are driving the dynamic, then clearly the lyric is going to show that type of content.
Absolutely. And it's, you know, it's very negative for the most part.
Well, let's talk to Lior Shamir about this. And he is one of those scientists involved in this study. And it's really fascinating. From the Lawrence Technological University in Michigan, you're going to find this to be an incredibly different...
The music of our lives.
Whose life?
Well, I don't know.
You know, I found out recently, we used to use that format here at the radio station where we're recording WATR, and I used to say, whose life? And
or,
now,
or the afterlife.
But no, I was talking to, well, many of those folks are listening in a more underground environment these days. But I must say this, that I'm in a rock and roll band, as you know. And recently I've been talking to people about where do you play and where do you play? Because we're not really the types of music anymore that most bars want. They want younger people to come in.
Right.
And they said, and I swear this is the truth, they're starting to play nursing homes, John. Now, wow. Somebody who's 75 or 80 or whatever, I mean, don't forget, in the 60s, that was now how many years ago? That was 60 years ago, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So... they were 20 at the time. Right. So it's not going in with Johnny Mathis. It's not going in with Frank Sinatra. You're going in now with the Beatles and the Stones, and they love it.
You know what, though? I think there's a yearning on the millennials' part for this music. They're buying a lot of the old music and listening to it on their...
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, but I'm saying you're finding a receptive audience at a nursing home for music that we still consider contemporary in many ways.
That's kind of
You know, one of the good things is, because as the drummer in a band, they're always telling you it's too loud. But since, well, some people, like myself, have lost some of their hearing, nobody complains about that, I guess. Well, let's go to Lior Shamir, a really interesting topic today on America Trends. With us on the line is Lior Shamir. And Lior's work as part of a team of experts at Lawrence Technological University in Michigan really did get my attention, Lior, I want to tell you. And I saw a headline in a British paper that said, pop songs have become angrier and sadder. And this is as a result of your research. Now, you've got to tell us, before we get into it very deeply, what kind of research did you do to ensure that these are just a verifiable results? What did you do?
Well, so that's what we did was a quantitative analysis of lyrics. So we applied algorithms, computer algorithms, that associate each word or phrase in a song with a certain sentiment. And then it goes for the entire song, and it averages all the sentiments expressed in a song, and then it can come with a sentiment, an overall sentiment for a certain song. And for that, we could do all the Billboard 100 songs, and that's how we could see what changes over time, how it changes over time. If it what sentiments tend to be expressed more in certain years compared to other years, and how it changes. So that's basically the the scientific foundation for the study.
So in this article, it said, in addition to happiness, sadness, anger, surprise, fear, and disgust, they also determine confusion, romance, nostalgia, sexual desire, and other distinct emotions. How complicated was it to really take this and try to, you know, make some broad statement about the direction that music has taken in its tone and its mood?
Right. So that goes statistically, because for one song, obviously for one song, you cannot make strong conclusions. But when you have hundreds and thousands of songs that, like, we analyzed, then you have sufficient populations to make a statistical analysis and get statistical significance. I mean, whether you test whether the trend that you see can occur by chance or not.
Mm.
And we saw statistically significant results that showing that, first of all, that there is a trend, there is a change in the way sentiments are expressed in popular music lyrics. We can see a clear trend for that. And the most obvious sentiments that changed were sadness, joy, and anger. And anger clearly increased, especially in the more recent years, the one or two most recent decades, where anger increases. Sadness also increases, and joy decreases. It's not completely linear progression or regression, but the trend is very clear.
Now, I know that you looked at the lyrics and analyzed them using, I'm sure, the latest in technology. What about the keys? As somebody who now is playing keyboard, you know, the major keys, which are happier, and the minor keys that are sad. Did you look at all at the composition of the music in terms of the melodies and whether they, too, were expressing that anger or just the lyrics?
Right. So, well, the study focused on the lyrics. So we analyzed basically the lyrics and how what sentiments the lyrics express. We did look into correlating between the lyrics and the audio, and finding those correlations. That the audio part of it is the keys. It's not all of it, but it's part of it. And we did try to find those correlations, but for those, just very weak correlation between those things. So that did not change a whole lot over time, and we didn't identify any statistically significant change over time in the way keys or audio is associated with the lyrics. The most significant change was, like I said, directly.
Interesting. Well, everybody still does these 1-4-5 songs, so it's always C, F, and G, or some derivative thereof. Let me ask you, in terms of today, and then we'll get back to an earlier, simpler time, I mean, rap is coming from a place of anger and frustration. And I want to admit to you, I love music, but Lior, this particular genre and this moment in time is something that eludes me in terms of my tastes. Well, so did the metal banging that went on for many years. So I discounted that in my own being as well. But, you know, the most popular music of the day is rap, and that is really coming from a very dark place, at least lyrically it is.
Right, that is correct. And we compared different genres of music, the lyrics, and indeed, your impression, rap is by far the angriest genre in lyrics. That is by far, but that's what you see, because the rap lyrics have always been angry. The change here is that, just like you said, rap music became more increasingly more popular over the years, and now it's probably the most popular, the leading, or one of the leading genres, while in the past it was a smaller genre. So the change is not necessarily in the lyrics of the songs, but it's mainly probably mainly in the way music consumer consume lyrics. So now we are more prepared and more willing to consume angry lyrics compared compared to 20, 30, or 40 years ago, where angry lyrics were not so popular and wasn't so much in demand like they are today.
Well, let's look at it this way. We've got a leader of the free world who only expresses vitriol in virtually every communication about something or someone. We have a lot of young people who are really frustrated because they can't get a start in this world with the debt load that they have assumed, the inability really to build their lives. So they're angry and frustrated. So then it would I would imagine the record companies and others are responding to that and saying, this is who they are today. This is the mood and the tenor of our society. So we want to highlight and market music that expresses that frustration. Is that what's going on? What's the leading edge of this phenomenon as you look at it?
I believe that the what drives it is the way music is being consumed and the dramatic change in the past few decades from music being released through record stores, where it was very controlled by the music producer who knew exactly what they're releasing. And now music is consumed, music is distributed, a lot of it is through social media. And the way people express themselves in social media, just like you mentioned, people express, feel very comfortable to express anger, to express extreme emotion through social media. And music, when it's distributed, just fits that trend or that environment of anger and sadness, and sometimes people expressing themselves in ways that that we didn't experience before. You mentioned the changes in politics and the way politicians express themselves in a way that we're not used to in the previous decades. And but it goes for everyone. We use social media. Music is distributed through social media, a lot of it, and that's these are the sentiments that you often get from social media. So it just fits in. The music just fits in how we as music consumers and society express ourselves.
But Lior, I go back to the 1960s, which was my awakening or coming of age, if you will. And my father was in the pop music business as a radio station manager. And he would have record companies coming to him with all kinds of material. And some of it was very angry. Eve of Destruction by Barry McGuire in 1965 was one of the most controversial records of all times. And it made it really difficult for radio station managers and programmers to decide whether they would even air it. So in that era, there was a lot of anger about the Vietnam War and the like, and there were commercial entities like Capitol Records and Columbia who would take advantage of that. They had to, because they had to express the mood in order to sell the music. But you're saying that the social media of this era, uncurated by record companies, if you will, is even more hostile and angry and is being passed around one person to another without the benefit of these gatekeepers.
That is exactly right. What we could see when you look at the analysis, you can see that during the late 60s and early 70s, there's an increase in anger and also disgust expressed in popular music, music lyrics. And that correlates with the change and what role music had in society. So during the late 50s or early 60s, the role of music was entertainment, it was for fun. And in the late 60s, early 70s, music started to get a different role, a role of political activism, social activism. So music was used for a different purpose very often, or much more commonly than before. And that changed the sentiments that it expressed. Then during the early 80s, for instance, you see a decline in that, and then a very sharp increase in the most recent decades.
Yeah, you go back to the late 1950s and you've got performers like Paul Anka, Ricky Nelson, Annette Funicello. But you also had that undercurrent starting with Elvis Presley. Can you tell us why the late 50s, as you see it, from a socioeconomic standpoint where the middle class was beginning to build in America, though many classes and many folks were still excluded, particularly African Americans. But what was going on in the late 50s that made it a time when we saw the least angry and the most upbeat songs?
Well, those days when popular music was young, and like I mentioned before, it was created for entertainment, for enjoyment, for fun, and those were the happy days. And everyone liked to enjoy music, even when often musicians express criticism, it was indirect. It was it wasn't so direct as it is, for instance, either today or even in the late 60s, early 70s, when you had like songs that were meant to criticize a political perspective, for instance, or a social perspective. And during the late 50s, you didn't have those, or you rarely had those songs. Mostly it was for the purpose of entertaining, of having people dance or have fun, or those things. Music did not have at that time the role of its social role that it developed, especially in late 60s, early 70s. Also in our time, music is often used, although less, much less, and than it used to be in the late 60s, early 70s. That's the time where music meant a lot, and we need to think whether music will ever had that role in society as it had in the late 60s, early 70s, and because now it's not. Although we do have some social aspects in music, but not nearly as what you used to have in the late 60s, early 70s.
Well, of course, that's because radio stations, we just had AM radio. Everybody was tuned to the same top 40. We were speaking a common language. It's not unlike the streaming of television today, where everybody's got their own favorites, and it's not as common that we all share the same appreciation, or at least the tolerance for the music we hear, which is all the same. So I guess everyone's able to find their own niche, if you will. How much can you attribute, when you look at the lyrics, to what is going on at that moment in time? So in the mid to late 60s, the Vietnam War. In the early 70s, Watergate. And let's bring it forward to 9/11 and then the financial crisis and just the crisis we're in today of polarization. How much can you look specifically at those years when those things are really at the top of the charts in terms of news, and then look at what's at the top of the charts and see a correlation?
Oh, you can definitely see it. You can definitely see it. For instance, in 1988, there's a very sharp drop in fear expressed in popular music lyrics, and we associate that drop, that sharp drop, to the end of the Cold War, war during that time. You know, before then, it's like there was a constant fear of nuclear war. Lots of you have plenty of songs that expressed that, either that fear directly or fear indirectly. That was the mood, and then immediately, because the Cold War ended in a very short time, within a very short time, and you see that change in the very sharp change in popular music lyrics. Another change you see in the year of 2000, for instance. Again, a sharp drop in fear expressed in popular music lyrics. We can correlate that to the fear of the Y2K bug that everyone was expecting to change the world and, I don't know, bring us to the medievals or something. That did not happen, but there was a fear of that, and we can see that too in lyrics.
Very interesting. With us on the line is Lior Shamir of the Lawrence Technological University in Michigan. And let me quote you. Well, who better to quote than you, Lior, on this as a co-author of the study? The change in lyrics sentiments does not necessarily reflect what the musicians and songwriters wanted to express, but is more related to what music consumers wanted to listen to in each year. Well, how did they know that? I mean, many are commercially attuned, but I will tell you, somebody who's writing tunes these days, I'm only thinking often of my own personal experience and something that might have happened in my life. Sometimes I'll write something that might be socially aware, if you will. But, you know, I guess those who have to think about the consumer because they're trying to sell millions of copies are more willing to reflect what's going on, even if that's not the mood or the mindset that they have.
Exactly, exactly right. Because we focused on the most popular songs each year, the songs that were listened to the most, the songs that music consumers like the most, and whether they are distributed by social media or just like you say by producers, music producers, they try to identify the mood of their consumer, so they can make the best selling hit. And they can choose the best-selling hit, and they can put their all their resources and all their marketing efforts on what they believe can succeed the most. So whether it's marketed through social media or by music producer, it because we focused on the songs that were the most popular, we link that change in sentiment with how music consumers chose their music and how what their preferences are, rather than what the songwriter preferences are. We can assume, and we know that many more songs were written during the time. They might have a completely different sentiment expressed in them, but they weren't so successful among the music consumers.
You know, when I go back to the 1960s and I see the confluence of forces that were going on, whether it was the beach sound from California, whether it was the Detroit sound of Motown or the British invasion, there were all these cross currents. And the African American performer finally was beginning to get their due. But what do you attribute the popularity of primarily African American artists today among both African-American consumers and white consumers of a certain age in America? Is that unusual that this form of music, starting out of frustration in very impoverished areas, has really become so popular among middle-class white consumers as well? What is that saying about our culture at this moment as you look at it?
Yeah, but I have to tell you, even during the 1950s, at the time of segregation, what things that kept people together from different races was one of the main things was music. And Chuck Berry, for instance, was very successful at that time, and many teenagers saw Chuck Berry, for instance, as a role model. They wanted to be Chuck Berry, regardless of their ethnicity. They wanted to be Chuck Berry. Little Richard, The Temptations, the Supremes, the list goes on and on. At that time, music actually led the way and led the way ahead of everything else. So music was the thing that kept people together. And that legacy obviously is also today, but that has always since popular music was young, that trend was already there.
But it seems so pronounced today. Well, I'm thinking of all, and I don't know all the rap artists, but whether it's Drake, whether it's Cardi B, on and on and on. I don't know other than who's left, Sam Smith and a few other white performers. They really have taken a back seat in the recent period. Adele. I mean, but they seem to be exceptions. Well, let me go to another study and get your response to it. There is a strong correlation, according to New York University and a study they just did, everybody's studying popular music, between the likelihood of recognizing a song and its play count on Spotify. And Spotify, they say, was launched in 2008, well after nearly 90% of the songs we studied were released, which indicates millennials are aware of the music that in general preceded their lives and are nonetheless choosing to listen to it. So, as much as I'm talking about the people who are really au courant today, it looks as if, according to this study, that the memory of songs that go back between 1960 and 1999, even among young people today, is far greater than their memory of 21st century songs from 2000 to 2015, while higher overall, it diminished rapidly over time. So what does that tell us about the enduring quality of the music of a bygone era?
Right. I think that at the time, music meant much more to people than it does today. And I'm not sure when we're going to see another era where music means that much.
Mm.
When people waited for listened to the radio to wait for their favorite songs, where people went to the record store, and when music was had a much more centralized role in society than it is now. And many songs that are very successful, whether it's a Korean rapper that is very successful at one time and then 2 years later, and the kids don't know that the song at all. And but those songs that were made at that time where music meant so much, those songs will probably stay forever because of what they meant, not necessarily for just for their musical quality, but because of what they meant to people at that time, and that probably stays. Apparently, it does.
Well, it's the way we as a generation could share our feelings and experiences with each other, and now it seems as if we're very fractured, and that kind of represents both our media today and who we are as a nation. Unfortunately, I know you can't speculate because you're somebody who looks at empirical evidence, but we would hope, and I heard it in your voice as well, that perhaps we can get back to a time when the lyrics are more uplifting. Not that I want Up With People to come back, or the Cowsills, or the Osmonds, but it would be nice if we had some happiness and joy back in our lives as reflected in our music.
I certainly hope so, because if the trend continues the way it does now, then it's not gonna be so good if that trend continues. It will have to change at a certain point. And but again, that reflects us as society and what we expect as society. I think a lot of it is dominated by social media and how we express ourselves in social media. And musicians probably are all probably aware of that and produce and create content of that type that we are used to. So they feed themselves. And so at a certain point, I agree with you. I do hope that we're going to see more diversity in music, and we're going to see artists expressing themselves and their ideas more than expressing what they believe will become popular. What instead of primarily satisfying the demands of their consumers, also express themselves as true artists to express themselves, even if it doesn't comply fully with the expectations of their fan base, but because of their artistic their artistic view, their artistic selves can express things that don't go with the
prevailing times. Lior, let me ask you in closing, and this is a very difficult question to ask, but I see where the spike in suicides, particularly among young girls, is prevalent in our culture. And you really begin to wonder whether the lyrics are an adjunct to that, whether there's any cause and effect. We see some terribly distressed people in our society taking a really violent response to their own discontent. What do you think is happening here in relation to music and these lyrics?
Well, I'm not an expert in, I'm not a clinical psychologist, so I'm not an expert in that. What I could speculate is that when it gets to a point of a suicide, probably it's not just the lyrics. Well, there's something else that mainly causes it.
Of course.
Listen to or reading lyrics of a song can add to that, can be the last straw. But it comes from, you can imagine that it comes from, there are many other reasons that lead to that, or other situations, either physiological or emotional situations that lead to that. But there's the suicide lyric, that was a genre that became popular, I believe, during the 90s or somewhat popular. And I tend to agree with you. It might not be a positive influence. It might not help to prevent those cases. Again, if they probably it starts from something else, but the lyrics can be the extra thing that make people take that bad decision. That's something. But again, I'm not a clinical psychologist, so I cannot make.
No, I understand. I put you in a very difficult spot with that question. Well, I'm somebody who loves beautiful music and great harmonies and great melodies, and I will tell you that we had our own sad songs. I'll remember Brian Wilson in Pet Sounds, where he said, "I wasn't made for these times," and I sometimes felt that way myself. But then, on the same record, he could do a song like "Wouldn't It Be Nice," or he could do one like "God Only Knows." So we had some great performers and great memories, thanks to the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, the Beach Boys, and on, and we were so fortunate to grow up, at least I was, in that era. Lior Shamir, again, an expert from the Lawrence Technological University in Michigan. And Lior, if somebody is fascinated by our conversation and really would like to dig into your research, where can they find it?
Well, they could find the most recent article in that Journal of Popular Music Studies. The article is there. Also, just Google my name and see. You can find my webpage and find all my work there. So
okay, it's L-I-O-R.
It's easy to find my work.
Okay, it's L-I-O-R, and the last name, S-H-A-M-I-R. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Right.
A fascinating topic on America Trends. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
America Trends podcast is part of the MHNR Network, mhnrnetwork.com.